Thank you. Good morning. Federalism was born more out of experience than out of as a theoretical proposition in North America. Of course, I'm sure we're all familiar with the fact that the 13 colonies that ultimately declared their independence in 1776 were founded by different groups of people from different parts of Britain at different times and for different reasons. During the colonial period, they had essentially no contact with each other. If you were in South Carolina, you were far more likely to be in correspondence with somebody in England than you were with somebody in Virginia, for example. But once the Seven Years' War ended and the British turned to the task of servicing the new national debt, they, of course, were going to impose on the colonists new burdens and lead them into cooperation in resistance. So in 1765, we see the first kind of milestone on the path to American federalism. In response to the Stamp Act of that year, Massachusetts called and eight other states joined them in sending delegates to a Stamp Act Congress that met in New York. And what they ultimately did was to adopt a set of resolutions saying essentially that nobody was entitled to tax the colonists without their consent. And most significantly, that because they couldn't be represented in Parliament, it was only their own provincial legislatures that could tax them. So from the very beginning of the dispute over taxation, people in North America were saying, we can't be represented in Parliament, and the reason was communication, 6 weeks at best, one way across the Atlantic. And that meant that if they were going to continue to enjoy the rights of Englishmen, they could only be taxed by people in their own provincial assemblies. Well, again, it's common knowledge that the British didn't accept this position, and what people don't realize is that in 1765, nobody was really thinking about independence in North America. But over the following decade or so, the American colonists repeatedly reiterated this position that because of the impossibility of their being represented in Parliament and because it was a historic right of Englishmen, they could only be taxed by their own provincial legislatures. The British, for their part, in trying to impose taxes from Parliament, restricted various other traditional rights of Englishmen when it came to people in North America, at various times curtailing the right to trial by jury. In New York, they went for years without even having a legislative assembly. The structure of the colonial government in Massachusetts was completely remade. And in 1774, angrily, a then unknown Virginia planter named Thomas Jefferson laid out, age 31, what would become his lifelong position on this question of federalism, or another way of putting it is on the proper relationship between the provincial legislature and the central government. And what he said in a famous pamphlet in 1774, A Summary View of the Rights of British America, was that each of the colonies was a discrete society, and the only legitimate relationship among them was through their common king. Parliament, he said, is a body that's foreign to our constitutions and unknown to our laws, which would have been completely shocking to people in Britain who thought of Parliament as the sovereign authority of the entire empire. Again, the colonists and the mother country were going to be completely unable to reconcile these absolutely contradictory positions, and so in 76, on the basis of a reputation that he had won with A Summary View of the Rights of British America, Jefferson was called on to draft a Declaration of American Independence. This is, of course, the primary thing we remember him for, but if Jefferson had had his way, he would not have been drafting the Declaration of American Independence. And in fact, he spent several weeks before he turned to that task begging to be relieved of the duty of serving in Congress. The reason was, as he said, that the contest was really about state constitutions. And in Virginia at the time, the provincial governor had fled, and what was left of the former colonial government, styling itself a convention, turned to the task of writing what became the first written constitution adopted by the people's representatives in the history of the world. Jefferson wanted to be in on that, and in fact repeatedly begged people who were running the convention, please send somebody else to be in Congress. If we were to end up with a bad constitution of our own devising, it would be better we had accepted the lousy one that was on offer from across the water. They denied him this opportunity, and he had to settle for writing the Declaration of Independence. Notice, when it comes to this federalism issue, his position on the relationship between Virginia and the Britain in 1774 was going to be translated into a similar position on the relationship between each of the now states and the central government in the United States. So through the end of his life, Jefferson, who lived until 1826, would always refer to Virginia as my country, and in fact, at one time when he was president of the United States, referred to the federal government as, quote, our foreign government. Why was it our foreign government if you were a Virginian? And the answer was, well, because his country was Virginia. And so the question of federalism for him was a matter of convenience for the states. This was about furthering republicanism in each of the individual states. That's where republicanism was going to be played out. In 1777, Congress turned to writing the first federal constitution, and that's what people called it. James Madison in the Philadelphia Convention referred to the Articles of Confederation as, quote, our federal constitution. This federal constitution featured an extremely weak central government, beside a provision saying that the states retained their sovereignty. Each of them retained its sovereignty. Shortly, people who were involved in the war itself, that is in the officer corps mainly, besides many congressmen and people who had been in important positions in state government, were going to decide that there needed to be more power, considerably more power in the central government. It's a fine question whether this was a majority sentiment even among the political elite. I think you can make a strong argument that it wasn't. But leading figures managed to persuade General Washington to participate in a movement to replace the Articles of Confederation with a more self-sustaining central government. They persuaded the states to send delegates to a convention in Philadelphia in the summer of 1787 by saying that the goal of this convention would be to propose amendments to the Articles of Confederation. And then once in Philadelphia, some of the leaders of this movement, notably Madison, but with others' cooperation, proposed instead a national government with a national executive, a national legislature, and a national judiciary. Now, of course, today we've lost the distinction between the word national and the word federal, but in the 18th century, these were alternative models. So a federal government was one in which the component parts came first, and the central government was given some power by the component parts for their convenience. On the other hand, the classic example of a national government was the one that was created by the French revolutionaries, who, at the beginning of the contention that was going to lead to the wars of the French Revolution within France, took the historic internal map of France and etch-a-sketched it. So all you were left with was the perimeter of France. And then they redrew internal administrative boundaries, all of these regions being more or less exactly the same size. Then power was entirely in the center, and the administrative subdivisions existed for the convenience of the center. So this is what some people in the Philadelphia Convention proposed. And as you might expect, they said that Congress should have a general legislative authority, that the federal court should be able to hear any significant case, that the state legislators should no longer have any role in choosing members of Congress, and logically, that Congress should have a veto over all state laws. But there were other provisions like this too. But the significant thing to notice about the Philadelphia Convention when it comes to federalism is that these plans of Madison and his allies in trying to give America a national government were rejected. Every one of those provisions I've just described was defeated. And Madison left the Philadelphia Convention persuaded that although this new proposed government was superior to the Articles, it was going to fail within a few years. And the reason that he pointed to chiefly was that the central government didn't have a veto over state laws. Congress had to have been given this, or a federal system simply couldn't work. He wrote to Thomas Jefferson 1 month and 1 week after the convention adjourned and explained to him how terrible this outcome was. So the point is that the Philadelphia Convention produced a federal constitution despite the efforts of the most famous, at least to us, the most famous delegates. Washington favored this idea as well. Once the Constitution was referred to the states for their ratification, former nationalists, Hamilton, Charles Cotesworth Pinckney from South Carolina, Madison, and Governor Edmund Randolph back in Virginia. I could name people from four or five other states who were leading federal convention delegates and then would be leading ratification proponents in their states. Sold the Constitution as what it was, which is a federal one, not a national one. And Madison, to the end of his career, was going to insist that it was a federal one and not a national one. Some people say, well, this is a politician, kind of oily behavior. I think there's a better way to, a more charitable way to understand what Madison was doing, and that is he always said what counted was what the people had consented to. What the people were going to be sold in the ratification contest was a federal system. So Madison thought it had to be treated as a federal system. In 1789, of course, with George Washington's inauguration as the first president, the new government was instituted. And imagine this, when Washington took his hand off that Bible, there was one person in the executive branch, one. Low taxes were essentially a mandate from heaven. But within a short period of time, at Madison's suggestion and the suggestion of other leading men in the federal political system, Washington appointed Alexander Hamilton to be his Treasury Secretary. And Hamilton proposed, among other things, that the federal government assume responsibility for all state debts, which Congress did. Now, this had the positive effect that Madison had prognosticated. Within a very short time, the interest that the federal government was having to pay on the war debt declined from 6% to 4%. So instantly, people achieved a huge saving in their taxes by having Congress adopt Hamilton's proposal. But there was also other reaction to this act, and that came from Virginia, where Patrick Henry, who had been the leading anti-federalist, at least in Virginia, arguably in the country, and Henry Lee, who had been a very vocal proponent of ratification in Virginia, co-sponsored a resolution of the Virginia General Assembly. And what that resolution said was, you told us this was going to be a federal government. It would only have the enumerated powers. We don't see anything in the Constitution about assuming state debts. Therefore, by the explanation you gave us last year, this is unconstitutional. We're going to keep our eyes on you. In 1791, Hamilton had another proposal, which was to create a Bank of the United States. And the standard version of what happened in response to that proposal is that Thomas Jefferson sketched out a classic account of what we now call strict construction, or a states' rights reading of the Constitution. But actually, if you check the record of the debate in the House of Representatives, you'll see that Jefferson's famous cabinet memo to Washington outlining the position of strict construction was taken verbatim from what Madison had said in the House of Representatives. So again, people were insistent on this idea that there was a federal system, not a national one. And what that meant was, in case the federal government wanted to undertake these measures, it might do so, but before it did, it ought to seek amendment to empower itself to take such measures. The question of federalism was tightly bound with other issues, economic, foreign policy related, slavery related, in the 1790s, and dividing the founding fathers into two political parties, two harshly opposed political parties. So if someone says to you, which founding fathers do you admire, saying, well, I admire them all, is not a good answer. It seems to indicate that you don't really know that much about them. Not naming names, but by the end of the 1790s, there was concern on the part of the people who were actually in federal office that the Jeffersonian opposition was not a loyal opposition. And when a quasi-war with France began in 1798. Congress undertook to adopt a suite of laws, the so-called Alien and Sedition Acts, along with a revision of the immigration law of the country that would make it more difficult for people to express opposition, actually outlawed it. This sounds like kind of visionary notion of liberal professors, you're going to have repression of people for speaking out. Surely that didn't really happen in America, but actually 25 people were prosecuted under the Sedition Act, and 10 of them were convicted. And this included every major Republican newspaper editor in the country, and one of the people who went to prison was a congressman whose quote-unquote crime was criticizing John Adams' foreign policy. There also had been an indictment on a common law charge of seditious libel in Virginia of another congressman the year before. And in response to that indictment, the federal indictment by a grand jury in Richmond, Jefferson called for the indictment of the grand jurors. And he said the grand jurors on that federal grand jury in Richmond were guilty of treason to Virginia. There then followed an interesting correspondence between Jefferson, the vice president, and his former law student, the governor of Virginia, James Monroe, on the question whether it was possible for somebody who was participating in a federal grand jury to be committing treason against Virginia. And Monroe's position was, well, you know, if these people have misbehaved, surely that's a federal question, and we ought to go to the federal government about that. And Jefferson's answer was essentially that loyalty to Virginia came first, and that anything that amounted to a move to prevent free discussion of political questions in Virginia threatened Republican government, and so he thought they were guilty of treason. Well, the governor refused to follow up on that, but the point is that you can see that this priority that I talked about before in Jefferson's mind, which was going to come to be the official position of the Republican Party, remained central to Jefferson's thinking about these questions and was going to be central to his party's thinking about these questions. In 98, in response to the Alien Sedition Acts, Jefferson and Madison famously penned legislative resolutions that were adopted by the legislatures of Virginia and Kentucky, spelling out there in the Republican Party's understanding of the Constitution. And the way they described the Constitution was by saying that the federal union had been created by the states for the states' purposes, the central government had been given a few powers for the states' convenience, and in case the central government behaved in a way that was unconstitutional and dangerous, note the "and dangerous," the states, and these were Madison's words, quote, have the right and are in duty bound to interpose. Now, the question exactly what that meant is another fine question, but one coincidence seems to make it rather clear to me, well, actually two coincidences. The first was that although they'd been having a dispute in Virginia about building a new armory for over a decade, it was in summer of 98 that they decided finally to do it. They put it in Richmond, began building more weapons and buying more weapons, and besides that, drilling the militia far more rigorously than before. And another thing is that a second rank, imagine the Republican high command with Jefferson and Madison at the top, and somebody in the second rank, a congressman who had been a vocal proponent of Jefferson's positions in House, the U.S. House in the 90s, publicly called for Virginia to secede. Jefferson, receiving kind of secondhand a letter from a Virginia senator talking about secession, that is a Virginia U.S. senator, wrote to the senator and said, "The time for secession has not come yet." This Virginia and Kentucky resolutions were the political platform of the Jeffersonians in 1800, and we don't have to ask, well, how did that turn out? Because what happened was that the people decided to turn out the Federalists in 1800, and they never came back. Jefferson had explained the likely Republican victory in 1800 before it happened by saying, once people realize what the tax burden of the Federalist military buildup is going to be, they're going to decide they like our foreign policy better, and we're going to win the elections. But after his party won, he always explained the outcome in 1800 by reference to their constitutional position. Well, he said, the revolution of 1800 was as real a revolution in the principles of our government as that of 76 was in its form. In other words, his position was the people decided at the polls in 1800 that they liked our, not the Federalists' constitutional position. They liked this vision of federalism that the Republicans had better than they liked the, I'd say, unarticulated or blurry idea of the proper relationship between the states and the central government that the Federalists had. So one last episode to illustrate the way that this worked for the Federalists, I mean for the Republicans in power. The Republicans, once they won the elections in 1800, held all three branches of the federal government for the next quarter century, essentially. And this included the only time in history that we have three consecutive two-term presidents, first Jefferson, then his best friend Madison, then their friend and Jefferson's former law student, also a distant relative of Madison's, James Monroe. In his last act as president in 1817, Madison was presented by Congress with a bill he had called for Congress to pass. So what had happened was that Congress had chartered a new bank of the United States with 20% of the stock to be held by the federal government, and the question became, well, what will we spend the profit that the federal government realizes on this bank on? And Madison's answer was, well, we could spend it on a new national network of roads, canals, and bridges. But then in a typical elliptical Madisonian expression, he said, if you find a defect in your authority, you should apply the remedy that the Constitution provides. So when Congress presented the bonus bill to Madison in 1817, he vetoed it. He vetoed his own bill. And his explanation was, I told you before you could do this, you had to amend the Constitution. So this vision of federalism, the idea that the central government had only the few powers the people had consented to give it, was for Madison so significant that he vetoed his own administration's chief domestic measure of his last 2 years as president. Thank you.